Graham, we normally start off by asking the guests to introduce themselves, which we will do in a couple of minutes. But Mike gave me a little bit of insight before we began that you have an interesting gangster rap. Is that true?
I like heavy rap music. Technically, that would be gangster rap and hip hop. Yep, we share that same taste. I've got that T-shirt on, Rat. Actually, I've got the.
Oh yes, have you?
Yeah, Adidas. my Adidas T-shirt on, but it's too cold to take the coat off. we share that same interest.
Most analysis sessions were always done to the backdrop of something quite aggressive, wasn't it?
Yeah,
NWA
I always won that. No shit. Yeah. You can allow it. In the office.
There was a big Frank Ocean phase as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, 2013. Yeah.
Yeah. What's Pyramids.
Is it Pyramids?
Yeah, Pyramids.
The 10-minute song. Yeah. Just reminds me of 2013.
Lineouts.
And Disclosure and Sam Smith, Latch. Remember that?
Yeah.
Not too heavy, but. No, I like all that music. My kids do. Well, my kids are grown up listening to it, and my youngest has got an incredible memory for song and lyrics, and he has to be careful.
Yeah,
how he sings around the house. Pretty
good. Otherwise, you get in trouble.
He does. He can just recall every word of every rap song.
Really?
Genius. Yeah. Scary.
Yeah.
Yes, in answer to your question, yes, guilty as charged.
Well, one of the things Mike didn't say was that he was also interested in that, so he cunningly left that that bit of information out. But so apart from the rap music, Graham, can you tell us what your current role is?
I'm forwards coach for Munster Rugby. We're one of the four provincial teams in Ireland. Been here a year. I love it here. Bloody love it. Great club, steeped in history, huge club, big following. A lot of people won't know the structure of rugby over here. We're centrally owned by the Irish Rugby Union, but not completely. But so they have a big say in who we can recruit. So there's a real focus on developing young Irish players. When you get your head around, it's quite interesting, actually. But no, I love the place. I'm a year into a three-year contract. Family were going to be moved over here by now, but COVID put a bit of a handbrake on everything. But hopefully that will take care of itself in the spring.
Yeah, and you and Mike obviously know each other from how many years at the RFU? And then obviously is it two Lions tours that you were both on?
Two, yeah.
Yeah, two, yeah. And then
12 years.
Yeah. Long time.
Never forget the day I met him. I'm not concerned. I can't tell that story. No, I don't want to embarrass him.
No, tell it. It's fine. You know, it's a bit sizist, but no, please.
No one's judging. Just be comfortable with who you are. No one's judging.
I'll tell the story then.
Go on. So, then.
Graham Orr's remarks on the first time that he met me, because it was during a meeting, and I must have been sat down first before Graham came in. So came in, everybody said hello, had the meeting. And then at the end of the meeting, obviously, everyone stood up to leave. And if you've not met me, I'm, you know, a bit challenged vertically. But my proportions are I'm mainly body, not a lot of leg. So when I'm sat down, I'm all torso. So when I'm sat down at the table, I look normal size. So Graham obviously didn't think anything of this until I stood up and immediately burst out laughing. Because he thought I was a normal-sized human being, which I'm not. And from there, the bullying began. I called my counsellor that story a few times.
There's a picture from our one of the previous series where we met Zach Mercer, and you know, I'm not tall either, but it's a little embarrassing seeing the height difference between me, you, and Zach, isn't it? Really, that's
yeah.
There's a reason why neither of us became professional athletes.
Yep.
So Graham, can you explain? Because obviously, you know, you had that kind of decorated rugby career before you became a coach. So, at what point did you start to kind of be involved in analysis and have people give you analysis, or you know, even do some yourself?
So at the end of my career, I mean, I played all my career at Leicester Tigers, and towards the end of my career, worked with some great coaches. There's a guy there called John Wells, who I ended up coaching with for England, luckily enough. He was a great man, great coach, learned a lot off him. And back then it was all videos. And I was always amazed how much work he'd done in preparing videos and opposition for us. And he had this multi-recording machine. We could put various tapes in at any one time. A huge thing, humongous kind of video recorder. And he would be churning out videos on set piece, just in terms of rugby's lineouts and scrums and breakdown threats and analysis, and giving us a video to take home on a Monday night. He put so much work into it. Then it developed into he's making DVDs, CD-ROMs. And then I'd say the mid-2000s, went on the Lions tour and came across Apple Macs for the first time. And they were using sports code, which pretty much the whole rugby world uses now for analysis. And I was blown away by it. It was the old white covered MacBooks, quite chunky, about an inch and a half thick. But
yeah,
they were loaded up with analysis and opposition. And we were players, never seen this before. And we thought, great, we can look at this. You click on a button, it shows all your opponent's involvement. That was my first taste of analysis. But I'd say around that time, in the early 2000s, John Wells was doing it for Leicester with videotapes. And by 2005, it was on MacBooks. And thereafter, I mean, I finished playing in 07, went into coaching. And then you're quickly meeting analysts. And they'll give you whatever you want to look for, which... it's impressive. Impressive.
And do you wish that you'd had some access to that analysis when you were playing as well? Do you think that would have had an improvement on your kind of ability?
We did. As I said, we did. It was all videotapes. We were analysing opposition. I remember back in the amateur days, sat on a Thursday night after we'd all been to work, sat around a big TV in the corner, you know, massive TVs, the big tube on it, analysing the opposition that we were going to be playing on the Saturday from old rugby special tape. That was analysis. You know, analysis has been around for a long time. But the way it's broken down and fed to you, and the ability to click a button and look at what you want, that's only come about, I'd say, the last 12 years. Well, since I've been coaching.
Yeah. And that sort of shift, everything shifted from analog, didn't it, to digital, and like you say, on MacBooks and laptops. And fair play, you've always been quite open-minded about learning skills and being able to do stuff yourself. Do you actually enjoy the analysis side of it, or do you just enjoy what you get out of it? Do you enjoy the process bit itself, or is it just the things that you can learn from it at the end that you enjoy?
I like the ability in a short space of time to look at what I need to look at. Because it's all been chopped up and fed, and there's buttons for various involvements in the game. The numbers are all out there, aren't there? There's so much data. I mean, we'll come to GPS, I'm sure, later on. There's a lot of that data I just don't understand, and I'm not convinced the geeks, the sports scientists, understand it either. There's so much data around there, but I like the ability to press a button and be talked to a place where I need. It's just the stuff I need to see. What teams are likely to do. Because all we're doing, it's an estimate, isn't it? It's an estimate of what they like doing in terms of opposition, or indeed what has historically worked against them. Because ultimately, they could be doing something completely different when you play them at the weekend. You know, there's that in the game still as well. And you've got to be careful not to forget that. You can analyse teams too much. But I like the ability to press a button. This is what they do in this area of the field. This is what has historically worked against them. This is what they like doing.
But you also do that for your players as well, don't you? I know you do a lot. You do one-to-one meetings with all your forwards in very much that same way as well, right?
Yeah, and all the individual clips are there on a Saturday night after the game. And you can go through. I went through a phase of sitting down with every player, just going through all their involvements. Now it's a case of, right, what do we need to look at? What do you think we need to look at in your game? Then, again, you can press a button for all of that, for those specific parts of his game. I'd say one of the greatest things I enjoy about coaching is one-on-one meetings, just going through a player, as what he wants to be, how we're going to get him better, I'd say that part and being on the field, having the banter, the crack. It's the best part of the game. Worst part, meetings. Coaches meetings. Just meetings.
You quite like a forwards meeting though, don't you?
Well, I can control the forwards meeting, can't I?
Yeah.
As I said before, I've reached new levels, Rat, by the way, now. New levels. You've got to engage the lads as soon as you start that meeting. And ultimately, I don't want them to work out what mood I'm in at all.
No.
They may need bringing down a peg or two from the weekend, or they may need lifting up. But I like those meetings. I like it punchy. I like throwing funny videos in.
So what do you do at the start then to get that engagement and that connection? And is it, do you like those one-on-one meetings because you have got that sort of rapport going with that
relationship? I like.
Is that what you then try to do at the start of a forwards meeting?
Yeah, engage
connect them. With them.
Yeah, put a funny video up.
Yeah.
I've got a bad habit recently of putting old videos of me fighting and stamping on people.
It's plenty of those.
Social media is cracking for this. You just find dodgy pictures of the lads or. Yeah. Stick them up on the meeting. Like we're into Peter O'Mahony at the moment for some of his stuff he's doing on Instagram.
Oh, really?
Some of the brands he's promoting. Oh, it's disgusting. It's a picture of him yesterday with a load of guide puppy dogs. There's a picture of him with a watch and a jeweler's like this. Nice. Which we all enjoy as a group. But no, I like the engagement with the lads in a meeting, and then you've got them, then you can show them what you want, and you can bring them down or build them up, and you can go to specific parts of analysis or things to look at.
So, Graham, obviously, at the moment, you're at Munster, as you mentioned. Previously, you were at Georgia, then obviously England as well. What is the main difference between coaching at a club level and coaching at an international level?
Well, obviously, it's day in, day out. You've got to balance your energy. International rugby, short pockets of time. You're working flat out. You can almost demand standards. You've got to fit in here or get the next cab off the rank. Club rugby is not quite like that. Sometimes you've got a group of players you have to work with who are not the standard of what you would expect because you've got various injuries or there's young guys you've got to bring through. It's a different energy. You've got to balance that emotion, that energy with yourself and the team. Obviously, the pressure's less as well with club rugby. You know, after a loss with England, you're sat in front of 80 media. And the worst thing was, if you lose at the end of a campaign such as an Autumn or a Six Nations, you've got to wait 4-5 months sometimes for another go. And you're stewing in it and you're getting hammered by the media in that time.
Does it, in terms of analysis, does it make it hard at international level that obviously you might have had to wait six months or longer between the last opposition game and the new game?
No, I wouldn't say that. The facts are still there from how they've played and what they've done in the game. And they as much as yourselves, haven't had a lot of time to change things.
I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because although there's big gaps between the games, you still only get the players a week in advance, 10 days in advance of that first match, don't you?
It's so you better still... now. It's better now because they have that week away, don't they? Be like before a Six Nations campaign. But that week away and going into a test week, you're still going into a game with probably six sessions.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no way you can radically change everything in such a short window.
No. What has been helpful, I mean, we had this this week. So our guys played for Ireland last week, beat Scotland. And within 24 hours of the game, they'd had stuff sent to them on Huddle, clips of just developments in our game that we've done since they've been away, just some calls and stuff. So they're able to bang, right, look at that. They come in Monday or Tuesday, right, we've had a look at what we're doing. We just crack on with it. That's good. That's a great use of analysis.
Particularly now with everybody, you know, having spent so much time apart, that ability to communicate online, send information, share information.
I mean, You do it respectfully. You don't do it while they're in Ireland time. But as soon as that finishes, like Sunday, they played Saturday, Sunday, they had stuff sent from us. Not too much stuff. So they're ready to come in on Tuesday morning.
Yeah. And would that be sort of broader game plan, tactical stuff, or more detailed breakdown, line out?
I'd say not line out or breakdown, because there's not much change there. But in terms of a few of our calls, and the game now is you've got to be clever what you're doing with the ball. I mean, England are getting criticised for being boring, kicking the ball. They actually don't want the ball. It's quite obvious because they've got such a good defence. But we're like that traditionally, but we're trying to expand the game with Steve Larkham on board. And we have a lot of phase shapes in attack, what we're doing with the ball. And you've got to manipulate defences, breaking it down. It's rugby league, basically. Rugby league phase shapes. So we've constantly evolved that in the last 2 months in particular, more than ever, because we had a lot of criticism losing to Leinster in the semi-final of the Pro 14 in the summer for not playing. And they're right. We didn't fire a shot. So we've developed our phase attack. So there's little nuances there, little running lines that they can look at in a diagram, and it makes sense. So and then you prep for when you start running on a Tuesday morning.
And are those multi-phase shapes that they can align in those shapes, and you know, similar to Rob Howley used to do, he always used to have multiple phase shapes for whichever phase of play and whichever players were available?
We have up to three phases off set piece planned, which is a very Australian, it's an ACT Brumbies thing, I'd say. But we now have more than ever a couple of phases in just phase attack.
Yeah.
So it can be from any receipt of ball, it doesn't have to be from set piece. So you got to know your role as a player, as a prop, as a back rower, you got to know your role.
And what line you're running.
Exactly. Because it works. Because defences are that intricate and clever now, and rushing now. It's about manipulating defences. It's rugby league, as I keep saying. This is rugby league stuff. It's telling lies, as far as I would say, right? Telling lies to the opposition, to the defence.
Glenn, did you have to learn kind of how much is enough to send to those players? You know, I can imagine it's difficult because you want to give them a lot of information, but obviously at some point they'll just kind of not take any more in. So is that something you learn over time?
I'd say it's a feel as a coach. Some coaches will send more than others. But you can overload them with detail. I mean, it's a collision sport. You win that collision. If you're faster into that collision, you're more powerful into that collision, you'll win, essentially, factually. It's a collision. It's quite a simple sport. And you can... I've worked with guys who are too much into detail. I've worked with guys who are very minimal, both equally as successful. So it's a feel for the group you're working with.
And traditionally, without getting bogged down in lineouts for too long, lineouts have always lent themselves to lots and lots and lots and lots of detail, haven't they? And
depends,
obviously that was
coaching it.
true. How did you find? Because obviously you were never a line-out caller as a player or jumper. How did you find upskilling yourself around the whole line-out technicalities over the years? Because I know you put a lot of time and effort early on into getting yourself to the level that's required.
You sit with the players. If you're fortunate enough to work with top-level players, that's where the knowledge is in the game. That's where the current knowledge is and what's going on in the game, and you have to respect that you're a prop coaching line out. So I see the line out through a prop's eyes, which is very simple, very simple. But then you have to be respectful of the guys you're working with. And you work with someone like Steve Borthwick or a Jeff Parlin or Ben Kay, you're not going to teach them much about the line out, but you can help them. I always wanted to know why they would do things, right, and then help them facilitate it. I struggle with saying, I didn't struggle actually. I'd go, why are we doing that? Why do we need these many calls when we know these will work? That's my biggest thing now, is why are we doing that? Why do we need that? Because if you have too many moving parts, you know, it only takes one daft prop to forget his role and the whole thing falls apart.
Well, do you remember we did that bit of analysis of what we did in training, didn't we? Do you remember? And like what percentage of it we were using in matches?
Yeah. Do you know what? Still use that analogy now. Here.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are we doing in training? We've cut down our lineouts.
Yeah.
Most of our tries are scored from just getting into the power zone, into their 22, similar to Exeter. We're very similar to Exeter. Not a lot of our tries and possession come from a line out on the 10 or on the 50 or on the 60-meter line.
Yeah. And there's always a bit of a battle, isn't there? Because like you said, the line out caller in training always wants to do 5 more or 10 more or 1 more, don't they? Whereas the head coach, and I've seen that sort of battle happening, wants to cap line out sessions at sort of 10, 15 minutes.
Guts.
Yeah. And he wants the lads off the field with the feet up, and all the line out boys are like, where's our line out time, aren't they?
Warren Gatland would have his line out menu on the back of a fag packet if he could. And I can see that. I can see that. But no, you work with guys, some guys like a lot of movement, a lot of manipulation. You have to be careful of the line-out caller who tries to make it so complicated that only he truly understands it.
Yeah.
He's trying to make himself irreplaceable.
Yeah, make yourself indispensable.
Yeah, and you have to just respect, as a coach, you just got to keep things right. Is this going to work? Are we going to use this? And without stepping on the guy's toes too much or dampening their enthusiasm.
Mm. And will you look at the trends in the opposition data in terms of where they tend to throw, who they tend to throw it to, formation? Yeah.
That's it. Button, you press a button. This, what works, what throws are working against this line-out formation traditionally, historically, factually? Where are they leaking possession? Where are they getting beaten in the line-out? Where do they like throwing? That's on a button.
Can you talk us through some of the new skills you've acquired since you've been coaching, Graham? Perhaps kind of focusing on more of the analytical stuff.
Well, I've learned about red wine, white wine. Don't mind a bit.
Which is your favourite?
Wax bat.
Wax bat. Heavy reds. It's a problem. It's a real problem. I like heavy, heavy reds, Malbecs. Some cracking wines, like that Man O' War rat that we like, that New Zealand, Waiheke Island stuff.
The rat cave setup back in the day was a working place of heaven, wasn't it? So we had a sort of analysis and coaches room, didn't we? Big table, all sat around it. Three big TVs at the end of the table, wasn't there? And you're training on Sky Sports, whatever. And then just tucked away in the corner was a little wine rack, wasn't there? With a selection of reds that everybody would bring in, and then a beer fridge, which again people would bring in little tasters and things like that. And then every Thursday,
Belgian phase, didn't we? You go through a Belgian beer phase,
yeah, very heavy Belgian phase, lot of quack.
I think we've
left
the alarm bells are ringing now as to where it all went wrong.
Why didn't we win many games? Jeez.
What about what? What have I learned? Sorry, joking apart. Traveling the world, of being tasting many wines. Now, what have I learned? I've learned that if I wasn't a rugby coach, I think I'd be a teacher. I love that element, being on the field, one-on-ones, getting the lads better, getting to know them, being part of it, that camaraderie, that connection. And you're constantly developing yourself, changing as a coach. I look back at how I coached 3 years ago. Never mind 13 years ago, and go, ooh, you find a style within yourself, but you got to keep, I'd say upskilling is a bit too cheesy because I'm not some astrophysicist. You got to keep evolving with the game and with the players. Some players like being fed information. Some players just need an arm around them to be told, you know, you're good, and building confidence. And I look back at my career, I wish I'd had a bit more of that, if I'm honest with you. That's not against any of the coaches I work with, but you're adding tools to your toolbox all the time in terms of being a coach. And I've reached a point now where I'm happier with how I'm doing it. I feel more comfortable doing what I'm doing. So you asked me, how have I upskilled myself? Was that the question? Or what skills have I acquired? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I know now what I'm delivering and how I operate is better than it has been.
Have you ever had a coaching mentor, Wick, or a more senior coach or someone that you've bounced ideas off or asked advice over the years?
Yeah, never for a period of time, but that's a tricky one, Matt, because who's to say they're right?
Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
You could have a mentor feeding you ideas or feeding back to you, just being a complete sycophant, or the other way. Who's to say they're right? But I've used guys who I connect with, who I respect.
Yeah, and I think I'm saying it not, like you say, as a sycophantic way, but as a way, just hopefully you've got that relationship with them where they'll be honest with you, and also have the experience and background behind them where they've been through some of the challenges that you might currently be facing with players or with a club or with a team, just to sound sense check what you've been doing or yeah, anything like that. You know, like I think back to Kevin Bowring at the RFU for a few years. And obviously other people use other people and their network and things like that, just as a sounding board more than anything.
Yep. I'd say I was thinking, as you asked the question, Kevin Bowring would be a constant for me there.
Yeah.
He was there. I remember having a chat with him at the Penny Hill Park when I was a player, coming towards the end of my career, and he invited me to come along to some England Academy sessions because I'd said to him I fancied coaching. And within 2 years of that, I was working for the RFU. I got a role in the National Academy in 2007 through him. And he was a constant for me over that 12-year period.
Mm.
I tell you what I thought was good, Mike. Bill Bezzett. Mm.
Yeah.
Coaching is like making love to a beautiful lady. Belgian chocolates.
Michael Jordan.
Take your time. Now, he was very good. He was very good. He was a very good, astute watcher. He'd watch training, give you feedback. He'd watch your meetings. I found him good.
Mm.
Of course, look at Lanny. Lanny swears by him, Stuart. Now, Stuart brought him to the RFU.
You mentioned, Graham, that a lot of, I think, some of the skills you were talking about were kind of admitting that you didn't know certain things, and you talk about coaching Steve Borthwick and Ben Kay and kind of not telling them what to do, but kind of asking them what they want to do and kind of questioning why things are done. Do you think that more coaches could benefit from that? Because I think certainly coaches I've had at a much lower level, it's kind of, I'm in charge, I'll tell you what to do, and what I say is kind of the correct way of doing things, where there's obviously, in your case, it's a bit more kind of, let's discuss this.
I'd be disappointed if a coach who worked at a higher level wasn't like that. I think you have to be to survive. Otherwise, you'll get left out. They'll literally leave you out of things. The players will stop coming to you. You'll get squeezed out. You have to have that affinity with them where you can listen. You will listen to what they're saying. Sometimes you have to be directive. Right, these are our standards around here. And I said it the other day, I'm not having it. I'm not having it. I'm not having it, lads. Right? I'm not. Yeah, sometimes you have to be directive like that, but only now and then. If you're a dog barking at them all the time, they become a yapping dog in the corner. If you bring out a big bark every now and then, they'll listen. But no, the level I've been very fortunate to work in is they've got the up-to-date knowledge. They're at the coalface, literally. You've got to listen to them and then just keep an eye on that detail.
Yeah. One thing that is, I always think, such a challenge about rugby, and in particular the area that, you know, you obviously specialised in for many years around the scrum, is that they always, you know, the rules are always changing. It's like the only elite sport in the world where the rules change every year, and you've got to always adapt with that, and the lads have got to adapt with it too. How do you stay on top of the changes and how they'll affect the scrum, how you analyse the scrum and then coach that?
That is where it's a great question, Hughesy. Why have you been waiting so long with good questions? that's great, because that's easier in the club game. I think about now, within a working week, how much we review We'll review Saturday on a Monday, then we'll train Monday, Tuesday. Then Wednesday will be off Thursday morning. We're reviewing Tuesday's training. We're constantly reviewing like scrums, mauls, lines. We've got overhead cams, you know, like the GoPro on the...
Yeah.
We've got one flipping drone, but the back's nicked out all the time. We've got a fishing rod with a GoPro on over the scrums. Yeah. Brilliant. The way the game is now, the proximity of the scrum, it's all about heads, what you're doing with your head. So we're reviewing that every day. And games evolving, and you look at your planning for opposition, you pick things up from other teams. Clubland, it's much easier to keep on top of it.
Just because you got the touch points every day, every week.
Exactly. Then if you're an international, you're meeting up for a summer tour, some of the laws might have changed since March, and you've got to adapt to that quick.
And the terrifying thing is you don't know how the refs are going to react to it either. Are they going to be super strict? Are they going to be a bit more laissez-faire? Yeah.
Right. They come in, the refs come in before every game with the front rows, right, I'm going to do this. Hang on, mate, you have no idea how you're going to referee. You don't. Why are you saying all this?
Yeah.
But I feel for the referees. I think it's the most complicated sport on the planet now, with constant rules and interpretations changing all the time. Too much for one bloke, but that's another story. That's maybe another podcast. Too much for one person.
Yeah.
So we'll end, Glenn, with our three questions that we ask everyone, our usual suspects questions. So what gets you most excited about using data and analysis?
If
there is anything. But yeah, it does. I've chosen option.
Yeah, unfortunately, listeners won't be able to see Graham's face at that question.
One thing I
want to delight. So that wasn't a scrum face.
The one data I use. I've got lots of faces, mate. Lots of faces. the one data that really interests me is GPS. You can measure the choice. It measures choices, right, as a forward. There's so much work for a forward to do. It measures choices to get to that ruck or to get to that tackle or not. And it measures it, X cells and D cells, high speed running, high metabolic load running. It's all there. And then when you get used to it, then you get presented with it every day, a report, peer to peer. You can see, it's like Moneyball, the film Moneyball. You can see who matters. It's not the try scorers. You can see who's doing all the work. We spoke about this before, Hughesy, where you can track a position on the field and determine if you're going to win a game, then this player's got to hit 17 rucks, 13 tackles. He's got to take 6 lineouts. He's got to have this many assists. He's got to get into this position in this speed. You can track it as to what it needs to look like. That's what I like about it. And in terms of data analysis of opposition, we have to be very careful what to believe, because they can do something completely different. But factually, the data shows what historically works against the team you're about to play.
But you touched on earlier that you're not sure whether people have quite got hold of the value within all of the GPS data yet, and some of the key stuff.
There's an accelerometer in this unit.
Yeah.
I've still not had the definitive answers on loadings. I want to know what the loading is like in a scrum, in a tackle. G-forces. I want to know what it's like. I mean, I'd love to know how much to load up my pack of forwards before we play against a certain team. Imagine you're the England rugby team, you're playing against Georgia or Argentina. You pretty much know what training you've got to be doing in the week, but I want to know how much. You know, what loadings are coming, things like that, tackle loadings. And I keep getting told that the numbers are there, we haven't quite got our heads around it yet. And the GPS stuff, sports scientists all have a different view on it. And you have to sift through the stuff and see what you want to look at. But that, for me, I'm looking at choices. You either get there quickly or you don't want to get there quickly. And I don't want you if you don't want to get off the floor and get there. I don't want you. You're dead. You're dead to me.
Are you making in-game substitution decisions based on GPS data?
No. Okay. No. We get asked this a lot. What are you looking at on your screens? Delay feed of what's just happened, live, and then you're
cycling website.
Sorry?
Cycling kit websites, usually.
website. I can't think of my favourite one there. So favourite website. That's irrelevant. But you're looking at what's happened, what's going on. And what I've come to find now is I'm much happier showing clips. Rat, we always try to do this. I'm happy showing clips at halftime. Because, you know, when they're all knackered, you can go through a list of things you've written down. And what I did find is I was spending more time writing things down than looking at the game. So now I will code live in the first half. Just with one button, there's a stoppage in play. I'll go back and code certain clips and just show the lads. And they'll either go, okay, yeah, sorry. Or, oh, all right, yeah, got it. Or they might argue with it or something.
Mm.
But I just show them the clips. I find that easier. That's what I have. But we don't, that's why I have a laptop in front of me for, but we don't look at GPS data. Crikey.
Is that a question for you, actually, Mike? Is that kind of universal? Is that not? Because a lot of people talk about how substitutions have been made because someone's tiling, but that's not often used?
Never. In my experience, I've never seen anyone make a substitution based on GPS data. The data you get live isn't accurate either. You need to download the units afterwards to get the accurate data, which even then isn't that accurate. It depends on how many satellites are overhead. If you're in a big stadium, you get a lot of blockages from all the concrete, which affects the accuracy of the data. So if you're making any kind of decisions based on it, it's not with the kind of reliability or accuracy that you'd want.
There's undeniable factual stuff that satellites, you don't need any satellites for. That's ball in play time. That's your possession, your completion. Penalty count's a big one for me. I want to know the penalty count. Because if that's over 10 by half time, we've got problems. We've got to start changing our habits because you're not going to win a game. Factually, you're not going to win a game. But it's certainly not GPS. That is just feel. You look at a play. We get to between 45 and 50 minutes there onwards. You are looking at certain players. Is he tiring? You might mic down to one of the conditioners sideline. Have a look at so-and-so for the next 5 minutes. Tell me what you think. It's all feel.
Yeah.
What you're seeing. And like front rows, if they bring on a big meathead at tight head prop very soon, I'm going to have to bring a fresh guy in against him, particularly if it's a wet day and it's a set piece type power game battle. You've got to match that power quickly.
So the second question is, what data do you use? But obviously we kind of talked about that with the GPS. So what does data not do that you would like it to do? So if you had a magic wand and you could get something, what would that be?
Wow.
Make coffee?
I've become a real coffee snob. I tell you, I only like fresh.
What do you mean become?
Roasted beans. I only buy beans that are under 14 days old.
Right. Wow, you have taken it to a new level. Right, okay. That's nice.
I'm not putting any rubbish into my body. I'm still working on replicating in training what we exactly do in the game. I don't think we're there yet. I look at what England are doing, this next level stuff that they put out every week. I look, and historically, I haven't spoke to Mike, Steve Borthwick, and the lads who still work there, how they train, that intensity. That interests me. I'm not sure clubland we can do that intensity all the time, but I'm still fascinated by replicating a minute of game time for a forward, replicating that in training without going live. You know, the rucks per minute, the sprints, we're kind of there, just replicating the exact output of a player in training in short pockets. And indeed, measuring that. I said earlier, I look at Excels, D-cells, an element of high-speed running. But putting that all together, you all add that stuff up. You know, who is working the hardest? Who is the most important player? We're nearly there, but not quite. I'd love a button to press that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It does, yeah. It sounds incredible.
Physical output of contacts running, just knowing exactly what they're doing and replicating that in training. I've kind of got it. There, I think it'd be three contacts, two sprints, the sprint meet, which we're still working on, but replicating that.
Mm. You want the whole picture of all the load on the player, don't you? You want the physiological, mechanical, and mental load to then be able to do blast that for periods of time.
I've kind of got it there. Genius that I am. I've come up with this matrix, and I call it the WIG score, right? And it takes elements of GPS and then just factual rucks hit, positive carries, blah, 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 into a number over time. And that gives me a number. And what it's telling me already is second rows do all the work.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. And it helps me suggest what second rows in the club are doing all the work and who we can't do without. And what props are doing the most output. But second rows are the one position where they get through the most work. And then you've got to look back in training and right, do we need to look after these guys more in the week? Do they need to do a 15K week, not a 20K week? We run a 20K week at the moment. In Georgia, before the World Cup, we were running a 30K week to try and get them fitter.
How did the players react to that increase in volume to 30K? Did many break down, or were they able to tolerate it? And did you feel you got benefit from doing that?
I've never seen anything like it. We hardly lost anyone. And I've not seen this forced adaptation before. We wouldn't let them have ice baths, no massages. It was like 35 degrees heat, and it was just like, get on with it. And that was their mantra. They got on with it. But yeah, I've never seen it. But there was hardly any injuries. We just got them tougher, literally. Got them tougher.
Really?
Yeah, from where they were. You can imagine where they were. You got lads playing in the Georgian Pro League, right? Then you've got guys on 30K a month in the top 14, big forwards, who will run a 8K week with a 27-minute ball in play time. You know, they're not used to being fit. You've got to learn, right, get these lads fit, and you've got this amount of time. Brutal.
Yeah. Brutal. Jeez.
In terms of, I know that you're obviously not on the TV side of things, Glenn, but do you think it would be beneficial to viewers to see something like the WIG score? Because I think those players go undulated the second those who hit a bunch of lucks, make about low tackles, but don't score any tries.
It'll come. It's a bit like watching the Tour de France, isn't it? They show heart rates. Mm. They kind of put some data up and the watts don't.
Yeah.
It'll get there. Sam Underhill has made 13 tackles and has ran. What will he run in an average game? He will run, I'd say,
six and a half K.
Yeah, 6.5K. It's amazing what our lads run. Some of the Pro 14, they're running 5.3.
Right.
Stop, start, wet night in bloody Rodney Parade in Newport. It'll happen.
15% less, yeah, it's a lot.
It'll happen. You get that data on the screen.
But yeah, and also, you know, a topic that's getting a bit of airtime at the moment around how scrums are broadcast as well. And perhaps the detail and the nuance and the sophistication that goes into scrummaging and the preparation and the time and energy isn't being reflected in how that's then communicated to the public.
No, that's it's a very particular skill, that. And you can have a lot of guys on TV trying to sound clever, who are just trying to baffle the audience. It's quite simple, really. What I do agree with is speeding the whole process up. It kills me in training. We're scrummaging in training. Right, we've got a scrum here. Go. And I've actually started now counting down. We've got a scrum here now in 5, 4, 3. Otherwise, so they're all day. I'm getting comfortable, pulling the shirt down, seconds in. Are we ready? Are we ready? And I'm screaming, lads, you're on my time. My time. I'm not waiting for you. In the game, Luke Pearce did it in one game last weekend. He's going, come on. Form the scrum. Come on. I've often thought, stop the clock. Right, scrum here. Scrum monster. Stop. Scrum goes on. Ball comes out. CJ Standard's feet. Start the clock. But then, I think we'd be there all day.
Yeah, it wouldn't speed it up.
Complete the game. We'd be there all day. But I would encourage refs, come on. The refs even start counting down. Look, 5, 4, 3. Right, scrum's gone. Right, over here again in 10, 9. You could have the crowd chanting it, couldn't you? On the big screen. 5, 4.
That'd be good. What, free kick if you're not there in time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Repeat offenders, yellow cards.
Mm.
Yeah, that was exceptional, that game last week, the Bristol Bears, Northampton Saints, where Luke Pearce was keen to stuff going. It was fairly exciting.
Was it that game?
It was a Friday night game. Yeah. Yeah, it was fairly exciting because he was, you know, because he wasn't letting it sit in the at the end of a box kick for kind of 10 seconds and all this kind of stuff. It was good to watch.
That was what was it in the Gloucester Quins game last week? They turned over that. The exit ruck. Use it, you've lost it.
Yeah, there's actually a turnover.
I think it was the second time ever that it's happened after all they've worn about it. Luke Pearce is quietly becoming a bloody outstanding referee, I reckon.
Yeah, I agree. I was looking at some stats for box kicks in the Automations Cup, and the median box kick time was 11 seconds. The luck length was 11 seconds for the box kick, which is unbelievable when you think that's twice and a little bit more what it should be.
Yeah.
It depends who you've got kicking. If you've got a pea shooter who can't put it up and who needs a load of time to form it, then you're going to need four blokes. We have Connor Murray who can swivel on his back foot and hoof it 200 metres in the air. He's incredible.
The best scrum half of the decade.
He's in that team, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Class.
Good play. Yeah, fair play.
Good pro, goes about his business. Class bloke.